Okay, let's call the meeting of the Stanislaus County Employees Retirement Association to order. Roll call, please.
Gordon Ford?
Here.
Maria Deanda?
Here.
Donna Riley?
Here.
Ron Martin?
Here.
Mike Lynch? Jim DeMartini?
Here.
Darren Garrett?
Here.
Jeff Rover?
Here.
Michael O'Neill?
Here.
Joan Pundenin?
Here.
We have a form.
Okay, I do not see anybody here from the public, so I will skip the public comment announcement. Moving on to item number 5, consent items. Has everyone had a chance to look at the consent items, and if so, do I have a motion to approve as listed on the agenda?
Motion to approve consent items. Second.
Okay, we have a motion by Jeff Grover, second by Mike O'Neill to approve the consent items. Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? So moved. Moving on to item number 6, semi-annual performance report by LSV Asset Management. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Hello, Derek. Good afternoon. We'll get started. Appreciate the invitation to join you again. With me is Bhaskaran Swaminathan, our Director of Research, and I'm Keith Brook, Director of Client Service. I'll give you a brief update on the organization, and then we will turn to portfolio performance and then how the portfolio is structured, and answer any questions as we go along. If I'd ask you to turn over to page 1 in the LSV book under section 1, a couple of points on the organization. First and foremost, not much has changed. We did name 3 new partners at year-end, so you'll remember that we're a general partnership, so there's 23 active partners in the firm, so we expanded from 20 to 23, but no changes to the structure of the firm. When we make new partners, they're granted equity, and then over time there's opportunities to purchase some equity, and that's how the system works. You see in the middle of the page, assets are about $70 billion total for the firm, and about $16.5 billion in the international equity strategy. So we manage a value strategy and developed in emerging markets outside the U.S. On your behalf, and kind of total assets in the international side of things about $16.4 billion. We saw positive cash flows into the strategy last year. This year it's been more neutral as far as flows in and out. So any increase in the firm assets and in the strategy, up with the markets and then some flows in. So you see in the middle of the page that some of the strategies, on the global side and the non-U.S., some of the smaller strategies are closed to new investors. We're still taking assets in the developed markets strategy that we manage for you, and we also have an emerging piece also. Page 2 is should look familiar. It's the organizational structure, and there is no changes to the key investment team members in the middle of the page with Joseph as Chief Investment Officer, and his roles and responsibilities remain unchanged. He's the founding partner. And then, across the top, Swami as Director of Research, Puneet Mancharamani and Mano Vermeulen, two of the senior portfolio managers. So we've had no departures. The most recent addition to the investment team was Titus Liu, who's a programmer on the system side, and that would have probably been about 18 months ago. So a lot of consistency, and we don't expect to see any major changes. So it's more or less business as usual. Any questions on the organization before we turn to your performance and portfolio? Okay. Why don't we skip over to page 6, and we have a couple of numbers here, and Paul presents the monthly reporting on the markets and so forth. Just want to point out a few things. At the top of the page, we have some of the large cap international indices, and you see in the first quarter the broad EFI benchmark, which is the developed markets outside the U.S., up 5.1%. If you scale down a little bit, the emerging markets were down about 1.7%. So your portfolio is about 75% in developed, about 25% in emerging, And it's your benchmark is the ACWI ex-US, which was up 3.2%. We have a line in here, and over the last year, you know, the markets have been up about 10-11%. Again, emerging trailing a little bit, but the ACWI up 8.4-8.5%. In the U.S., we've seen a recovery in value. I mentioned we're a value manager, and we like stocks that are cheap on a number of different measures, looking at cash flow, looking at earnings. And in the U.S., we've seen a recovery in some of the value areas. Outside the U.S., not as much, and part of it is that Europe continues to struggle. And we don't have a top-down view of the world, but where we've seen more of a recovery in the U.S., it's been modest, it's been slow, but it's been a recovery, and value stocks have done quite well. You see in the first quarter, and over the kind of 3 and 5 year period, we have this line called MSCI EAFE value versus growth spread. So still a little bit more difficult environment for value, but we're starting to see maybe a little bit of signs of life, hopefully, but more so in the U.S. There's been kind of a flight to safety, if you will, with assets moving towards consumer discretionary names, utilities. Outside the U.S., that'd be names like Nestle and British American Tobacco, kind of these safe, large consumer names that have been bid up, which we tend to avoid a little bit. But your performance is on page 7. And across the top of the page, we have the annualized periods, the first quarter, the 6 months since we last reported to you, the 1 year, 3 year, 5 years, and since inception. So we have about 8.5 years of performance in that blue box over on the right-hand side of the page. The second line is your net of fee performance. So in the first quarter, your portfolio is up 4.2% net of fees versus 3.2% for the primary benchmark and 1.8% for the value benchmark. Over the last 6 months, again, since we last spoke, your portfolio is up 10% versus 9.2% for the broad benchmark and 8.4% for value. Similar over the last year, kind of 3 years and 5 years, where we've been outperforming the value benchmark and have been a little bit ahead of the core benchmark. Over the last 6 months, I've mentioned that there's been a little bit of a flight to safety, where consumer staples, healthcare areas have done quite well. We've been a little bit more overweight energy, telecommunications, which have lagged a little bit, but our stock selection in a number of areas has kind of overcome that in the energy sector and materials, and we've also had good selection within the emerging markets. So we've been able to add a little bit of value, particularly this year. It's been off to a good start, about 100 basis points in the first quarter, to kind of bring that six-month number up to about the same.
Just a couple of things I wanted to just interject here for a second, following up on what Keith mentioned. On the previous page, on page 6, when we looked at the large cap international indices, you see this line that on page 6, MSCI EAFE value versus growth spread. So this essentially tells us how did value stocks perform relative to growth stocks? How did cheap stocks perform relative to expensive stocks in these markets? And you can look at the last quarter, 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, and 5 years, and you see a negative number. What that tells you is that over the last 5 years in this space, value companies have underperformed growth companies. Cheap companies have underperformed expensive companies. Now, this is relevant to us. This is important to what we do because we are a value manager. We are a deep value manager. We tend to buy the cheaper companies. We tend to buy companies that are low PE. We tend to buy companies that are, high cash flow yield, high EBITDA to enterprise value. So that's where we do our overweighting. So if you look at our portfolio attribution, the stocks within the benchmark that we buy the most and we overweight are the cheaper companies, and that's been a drag for us. That style has been a drag. So you can see that also on page 7. When you look at the value benchmark, the value benchmark consistently has been underperforming the core benchmark, the broader benchmark. So the MSCI ACWI ex-US value is lower than MSCI ACWI ex-US. So that's essentially a drag for us in terms of the style. In spite of that, we have managed to outperform a little bit in the even the core benchmark because of good stock selection. So our stock selection, what Keith mentioned, has been good enough to offset the style drag we are having. The fact that we are kind of running upstream when, in general, the cheaper companies are not doing well, but the cheaper companies we are buying have done somewhat better than the benchmark because of good stock selection. Historically, if you look at our performance, actual performance, as well as back testing that we have done simulation, periods which have been difficult for value have always been difficult for us because we tend to be deeper value than the value benchmark. So if you go to page 8, for example, you will notice that your portfolio, it trades at a healthy discount, obviously, to the MSCI ACWI ex-US benchmark. But it also trades at a healthy discount to the value benchmark. And that's what I mean by deep value. We buy companies that are even cheaper than in the value benchmark. And the reason we do that is that historically, over the long run, buying the cheapest companies has been the best strategy in terms of earning abnormal returns. So that's why we do that. But in periods when value is underperforming growth, the cheapest companies are going to underperform the less cheap companies. So in other words, the deep value portfolio that you have is going to underperform even a value benchmark. But in spite of that, we have been able to deliver some outperformance because of better stock selection in the various sectors and industries that we tend to buy into. So I just wanted to give you that big picture in terms of performance and style over the last 5 years.
Given that, Swami, and we had this discussion with you a few years ago, it might have been before your time even, wouldn't the ACWI ex-US value index be a more relevant index for you than the core index?
That is true. Let me put it broadly. The value benchmark. I mean, as you know, in our U.S. product, we are always benchmarked to a value benchmark. We don't use the core. In the international markets, there is a reason why I think historically people have used the core benchmark because the financials were such a strong component, big component of the value index. So, if you turn to page 9, you can see that if you look at the value benchmark. 38%, almost 40% of the portfolio is value benchmark.
Nice. And your portfolio is more in line with the core.
More in line with the core. Okay. And people were nervous about having a benchmark where one industry had such a big...
Stop. I got it.
But you're right. We're going to be more alike the value benchmark from a characteristic standpoint. And from a performance standpoint, we should correlate a little bit higher with that. So it's... We think that over time we should be able to beat either one of those two benchmarks with the way we approach the market, but there are going to be periods of time where we're going to have a little bit of a headwind and within the sector. And part of it is Swami mentioned, but again, names like British American Tobacco trading at a big premium, Nestle, those type of names, that's what we would avoid. And there's been, particularly in Europe, more of a preference for those type of stocks, the cheaper names. That are they're making money, they're generating earnings, generating cash flow, are being just a little bit left. But we are again within our universe. We've been able to pick some stocks with that have done quite well. Yeah. Other questions on performance, either short term or long term, or expectations going forward.
When do you think the oil stocks have dropped so much? Royal Dutch Shell, I know that's dropped, but just about all the oil companies have. Any reason why that's happening?
Part of it is the kind of the flight to safety phenomena where people have been nervous about global economy. People have been nervous about the debt to GDP ratios. So people have felt that I just want high dividend yield companies, fixed income like securities, in the equity markets. Obviously, fixed income is also very expensive in the sense the yields are at 1.7% 10-year yield in U.S. So people have felt that fixed income looks so expensive. So where can I get some yield? This is the thing, the going after the yield, because the U.S. The Federal Reserve has kept the yields very low on everything, right? So people are going after yield. So people are willing to pay extraordinary premiums for high dividend yield stocks. 4%. I mean, if you look at your portfolio, you can see the dividend yield on your portfolio is about 4%, roughly the same as the value benchmark. And yet, we are not paying a premium for that because your portfolio is trading at a discount to both the core benchmark and the value benchmark. But many investors have been willing to pay a premium in terms of their price-to-earnings multiple and price-to-cash flow multiple, price-to-book multiple to get 5%, 6% dividend yield. In other words, if you look at staples companies, if you look at utilities, people are willing to buy them at 18 times earnings, 19 times earnings for a 5, 6% dividend yield. And so the more cyclical names, you know, energy is a cyclical area, consumer cyclicals, they kind of been left behind. I mean, if you look at our portfolio, we actually like energy in the sense that we are at 12.6% weight to the sector, and the benchmark is about 9.7. So we are actually overweighting this area by 3% because we think the valuations are so attractive. And for the reasons you mentioned, they have fallen in value, they look cheaper, they think they look more attractive, and we as a deep value investor, as a contrarian investor, we are willing to go in and give that kind of overweight to that area. But we think that paying 18 or 19 times earnings for 5% dividend deal, we think is crazy because it's just too expensive. You know, if you buy, even though you're getting that dividend yield, if you're paying such a huge premium to the market in terms of valuations, and yet they are not expected to grow at a rate faster than the market, that's a risky investment. So that's why we like areas, we like stocks which are generating good earnings, good cash flows, but the market is kind of discounting them. Those are the stocks we want to buy, and you'll see that's what we are overweighting.
It's interesting. Some of our picks within energy have done well. It's just the overall sector, as you alluded to, has struggled from, and I think Swami pointed out the cyclical nature, but names like in Austria, we have OMV, which has actually been a positive contributor. Some of our emerging companies, China Petroleum, I think has done pretty well, but it's the big oil and gas companies that have done poorly in the universe in the energy stocks. And some of the, you know, the refiners in the U.S. have done well, but there's not a whole lot of, you know, pure refiners in the outside the U.S. that we would be buying. That's the refiners are one area that's done well within the U.S.
As the current emerging market weight is almost equal to the benchmark,
mm-hmm.
is that generally a true statement over all periods of time, or yes?
Yes. Okay. We always stay, we are not taking any bets on countries. We are not taking any bets on regions. We are not saying that this region is going to do better than the region. We focus on stock selection, bottom-up stock selection.
And how does your model deal with Europe today, where a lot of companies are valuation metrics cheap on a historical basis, but given what's going on there and growth rates in Europe, you know, there might be a reason why they're cheap, I guess.
That's correct. I mean, if you look at the value recovery we are beginning to see in U.S. and international markets, value stocks started doing really well about 9 months ago in U.S. So U.S. Had a very good year last year in terms of value strategies. This year to date, it's been doing well in U.S. so far. The other international region where value has come back very strongly is Asia-Pacific, ex-Japan, where value has come back very strongly. That's Hong Kong, Singapore, Australia, New Zealand. Europe has been a laggard there. I mean, value has been slow to recover there, although the bleeding kind of stopped last year in Europe. And so it's been kind of slow to recover, and for the reasons you mentioned. So, you know, because we tend to be country neutral, we are not taking any bets on regions or countries. We still are trying to buy the attractive names in those countries. There are attractive names, well-run companies in bad countries. I mean, there are stocks in Spain that we like. Banco Santander is a good example of a bank that's a good bank in a bad country. It has a lot of operations outside Europe, in Argentina, in Brazil, and in Latin America. Yet it gets dragged down with everybody else because it's in, you know, everybody says, but this is a Spanish company. That's the kind of the mistakes investors tend to make, as opposed to saying, well, that may be a Spanish company in Spain, but a significant portion of the revenues is coming out of Spain. So why should this company be treated as badly as the other companies? But that's, people don't make those distinctions. We try to make those distinctions. We try to buy the good companies, well-managed companies, even though they may be in a country where the macroeconomic situation isn't as great. So that's how we kind of deal with those things. We think we want to focus on the companies, not as much the fact they're incorporated in this place, if they're still well-run and well-managed.
All right, does anybody else have any other questions? All right, well, thank you both very much.
Thank you. It's great to see everyone. We appreciate the business and the chance to come out and give you an update on things.
Exactly right.
I think we may stay for a while. We may miss our flight back tomorrow. This is it's supposed to be 40 and raining in Chicago. So,
thank you, everybody.
Thanks again.
Thank you.
Make 20% again next year with you and your Okay, we're going to move on to item 7 now. Kathy's going to get them on the phone. Semiannual report by Pyramus Global Advisors.
Sam, Sarah.
Rick, any insights on why it's so up and down for LSB?
Yeah. I would guess that excess returns should be random across managers, wouldn't you?
Wasn't there an issue with the custodian and the exchange?
And that's why we kind of look at the cumulative. What have they done over the longer period of time?
Paul, was part of that the custodian with the exchange rates on our internet?
Yes. Actually quite well.
Yes.
Yeah.
Especially for pure
numbers. But
yes.
It does. All over the board on value added.
Yes, it does.
Are we ready?
You know, we tend to find that all of our managers have a bias. They do well in terms of excess returns when markets are doing well. And they don't do so well in terms of excess return when markets are not doing well. Which, yeah, I wouldn't guess it. I would think that a manager's excess return shouldn't be that much correlated with whether markets are going up or down. Because what they're looking at is just to beat the benchmark. The benchmark could be negative 10. If they get negative 9, they've done their job and beat the benchmark.
Right.
Ready?
Ready.
Okay, still there? Okay, one moment. Okay, you're on speaker.
Well, fine. Can you hear me clearly?
Yes. Go ahead.
Excellent. Well, good afternoon, everybody. This is Michael Strong, the lead portfolio manager for the International Growth Strategy that we manage on your behalf here at Pyramus. Also on the phone today, I have Chris Stewart, who is one of the institutional portfolio managers, who's part of the lead portfolio management team, and also our account executive, Melissa Boise.
Hello.
Hello.
Good afternoon, everybody, again. So are you all set to start?
Yes, go right ahead. It's all yours.
Oh, excellent. And how much time? I just wanted to be respectful of your time today. How much time would you like us to speak for?
20 minutes.
20 minutes would be fine.
20 minutes or so? Okay, great. Well, let me just check then that everybody has a copy of the presentation in front of them.
Yes.
Yes, we do.
Excellent. Well, if I could ask you to turn to page 4, first of all, I just want to remind everybody of the process and also just mention a change to the lead portfolio management team that will be happening effective the 30th of September. So if everybody's on page 4, you can see here, just to remind you, the way we manage this portfolio is that the stock selection is done by 5 different portfolio managers, each of whom is responsible for choosing stocks in their particular region. So, you know, moving from left to right, we have Cedric de la Chaise in London, who's responsible for European stocks, and Eileen is the Japanese equity manager, et cetera, et cetera. And the role of the lead portfolio management team, which is myself, Brian Hosley, and Chris Stewart, who is also on the phone, our direct investment role is the regional asset allocation. We will take a global overview review and decide whether relative to your benchmark, the MSCI ACWI XUS Index, how much money we want to put into Europe, into Japan, the Pacific, and emerging markets in Canada, respectively. And I'm not sure if you're all aware of this, but certainly I think we did inform staff. I shall be retiring effective the 30th of September. And at that point, Brian Hosley and Chris Stewart, who've worked with me for 7 years now as the lead portfolio management group, they will be taking over as the co-lead portfolio managers for this strategy. And as I say, that will take place effective September the 30th. I don't anticipate that there's going to be any significant changes at all to the process. You know, our primary role, as I said, the investment role is the regional asset allocation. We're also responsible for monitoring all of the regional portfolios. We handle all the cash flows. And because of the nature of the strategy, we tend to do most of the client meetings as well. But I've always considered the three of us, Brian, Chris, and myself, to be totally interchangeable. But at the age of 65 and having worked nonstop since 1969, I have decided that it's time for me to call it a day. I'll just pause there to see if anybody's got any questions about what will be happening in the future.
No, it doesn't appear anybody does. Go right ahead.
Okay, fine. All right. Well, thank you very much. And as I say, Chris is on the phone today. Brian is not available. He has another client commitment. So why don't we start by just giving you a quick overview of what's been happening in the equity markets in the most recent period, and we'll talk a little bit to our outlook. So if I could ask you to turn to page 12, first of all, and Chris will just give you a brief overview of how we see the markets at the present time, and then I'll talk about the recent relative performance of the portfolio and describe some of the stocks and positions that have added to the relative value and some that have also detracted. And we'll pause at the end of each session for questions. So, Chris, do you want to start on page 12?
Absolutely. I'll keep my comments fairly brief. We can certainly answer questions, but I think we'll save the bulk of the time to get into the portfolio. Again, on page 12, a quick market summary of the first quarter. The quarter really had almost two halves. By the time in February, when the word Cyprus began to appear on our headlines, things changed very drastically for especially the European financials. And, of course, brought the European debt crisis back to the fore. The Italian elections were also a stumble on the path to coming up with a good long-term solution to the crisis. As you may be aware, a man whose prior work resume has been as a comedian won 25% of the vote. And Berlusconi, who is probably even worse, got back into power with an even larger percent of the popular vote. So we continue to wait and see if there will be an effective coalition government in Italy. Turning to Japan, Japan has had an amazing run. When you look at the November low, the equity market is up more than 56% since then. In the first quarter, in local currency, the Nikkei was up 21%, but because of the weakness of the yen, and again, this is one of the policy levers operated by the new Abe administration in order to generate growth, the strength of the currency has led to only an 11% gain in U.S. Dollar terms. We do think that certainly, if successful, Japan will continue its run. We will know more after the July upper house elections, which we think will go Abe's way, which will allow him to do more structural reform in the economy. The new Chinese government is implementing its own policies. This is taking time as the central government has been in place for some months now, but of course the regional provincial governments take time to be put into power. It's a bit uncertain. 7.7% growth in China that just came out this week was a disappointment to some, but certainly in line with the guidance that the government had been giving. Certainly, all eyes are on China within the Asian part of the portfolio, and we continue to monitor that closely. And lastly, the U.S. Continues to chug along with somewhat decent earnings growth, although no one's expecting very strong performance. The market perhaps has gotten a little bit ahead of itself, but again, we're somewhat less worried about the U.S. than other regions of the world. Our outlook on page 13, again, the markets certainly in the last few years have been dominated by macroeconomic trends, but also sometimes these are overwhelmed by policy issues. Of course, the sequester and the fiscal cliff in the U.S. Europe was is very much influenced by what the European Central Bank does, and the Governor Draghi's comments in July that they would do whatever it takes to preserve the euro certainly led to a very strong market environment in the second half of 2012. Going on to the risks, again, we don't believe that the problems of Cyprus, a very small financial center that is known for maybe money laundering is too strong a word, but being a tax haven, we don't think that's a template for the rest of the Eurozone, but certainly there were concerns that that the initial response there to take deposits as a way of bailing out the banks would be more broadly shared. We don't believe that's the case. Again, we're waiting on the Japanese upper house election this summer, and we're watching Japan with a sharp eye, as well as the U.S. economy. So a very quick round the world tour. I'm going to pause there, and if there are no questions, we'll move back to Mike to go into the portfolio in more detail.
Doesn't look like anybody has any questions. Please proceed.
Okay. Terrific. Well, this is Mike Strong again. So if you could turn to page 15, that shows you an overview of the short and longer term performance on the portfolio. So if everybody's looking at page 15, and if you just look at the second column from the left-hand side, you can see that the portfolio's net return, that's net of fees over the last 6 months since we last spoke, has been just a fraction over 10%. The outperformance relative to the MSCI ACWI XUS index has been 100 basis points, just on 1%. We've seen positive returns in terms of stock selection adding value in Europe, Japan, and Canada, whilst the stock selection in the Pacific Basin actually detracted from returns over that period. In Europe, we were seeing very good individual stock selection in areas like financials over the last 6 months. Some of the stocks we owned, and I'm thinking of UBS, the big Swiss investment bank and retail bank, and Barclays in the UK, and also Lloyds. Some of those stocks are up 30% over the last 6 months. They performed very, very strongly during the fourth quarter of 2012. As investors' appetite for risk increased, and there was a general sentiment that the Eurozone's crisis might be abating. So we saw actually very strong returns from a lot of those banks, of course, in Europe that had performed very poorly during the financial crisis. During the first quarter of 2013, however, more issues in Europe surfaced, as Chris has alluded to, including the bankruptcy in Cyprus, and also concerns over the outcome of the Italian election, and the ongoing recession in peripheral Europe. And as a result, the banks gave up quite a bit of their improved returns that they'd achieved in the fourth quarter. But overall, for the 6 months through the 31st of March, we're still looking at returns on many of those European banks that we held in the portfolio at between 20 and 30%. So that was very positive for the portfolio. In addition, the consumer discretionary sector, which is a significant overweight for us in Europe, continued to do very well. on the back of Chinese demand, companies like PPR, which manufactures luxury goods in both the clothing area, they own Christian Dior, for example. BMW also performed very well on the back of still strong demand for those luxury autos in China as well. And in addition, Continental Tires, which has a very big original equipment market, was also a very strong contributor during that period. Elsewhere in the portfolio in Europe, being underweight telecommunications companies was very beneficial. We didn't own any of the big sort of national telecommunications giants like France Telecom, Deutsche Telekom in Germany, and Telecom Italia. All of those companies continue to suffer in the current environment, which is moving obviously much more to mobiles. We were also underweight utilities, and those have been very poor performing stocks, primarily really throughout 2012 and into 2013. And then if you look down that column further, you can see that over the 6 months, Japan outperformed its benchmark, the MSCI Japan Index, the Japanese portfolio, by almost 2%. Again, we were seeing very good returns from some of the consumer discretionary stocks that we own there, including Fuji Heavy Industries, which are actually 90% of their business is the production of Subaru autos, and with very strong demand. Interesting enough, with these are four-wheel drive vehicles, but they're experiencing very good demand in California. That stock was up 90% over the last 6 months, phenomenal increase, and we had a big overweight to that particular stock. We also had a big overweight to Bridgestone, the Japanese-based tire manufacturer, which was up nearly 50% during the period as well. And also, on the back of the new initiatives by the new Japanese government, which Chris alluded to, and also the new governor of the Bank of Japan, who is determined to focus on rejuvenating the Japanese economy, ending 20-plus years of deflation. We saw some of the Japanese financials also doing very well, certainly in the most recent quarter. And in addition, some of the domestic players in the consumer discretionary area, some of the retail stocks in the portfolio also did extremely well for that part of the portfolio. The biggest area of outperformance for us over the 6 months was actually in Canada. And if you look further down that second column, you can see the active return in Canada was over 500 basis points, 5.1%. Actually, Canada has been lagging, particularly this year, in terms of its performance relative to other regions in the world. As material prices have softened, the Canadian economy is very dominated by raw materials. There are huge mining stocks there. And also, what we were able to do is identify that although the price of gold was strong in 2012, it started to weaken in 2013, and we saw some fairly poor execution on the part of some of those Canadian gold miners. So we were fairly naked that particular part of the raw material sector, and that was very beneficial to the portfolio as those stocks performed very poorly, even in an environment where most of the material stocks were not doing very well. And then the other stock that really helped us in the portfolio, we had a very big overweight to a company called Norbord, which actually makes a lot of the wood products that go into U.S. housing. And as the U.S. housing market has improved, that stock rose by nearly 100% over the last 6 months. So that was a very beneficial position for us. And then also within the energy sector, we were underweight a lot of the Canadian oil sands companies. And as the U.S. Shale gas and the new oil reserves have been discovered and are starting to come online, the Canadian oil sands are a very expensive source of oil, and it's very difficult for them to export that oil anywhere other than to the U.S. primarily, because there aren't the pipelines heading out to either coast, which would enable them to ship the crude oil overseas. So being underweight that sector as well has also been very beneficial in Canada. So those were the primary areas of the stronger performance during the quarter. The one area of weakness for us really was the Pacific Basin over the last quarter and 6 months, where we underperformed on a six-month basis, the local index, by about 200 basis points. And that was particularly in financials, where we were underweight Australian banks and overweight Chinese and Hong Kong real estate developers. And a combination of the fact that the Australian banks had avoided all of the excesses of the financial crisis meant that that was one of the best performing areas in terms of retail banking across the world in 2012 and into 2013. So that really hurt the portfolio. And in addition, moves by the Chinese government to take the heat out of the Chinese residential property bubble also had an adverse effect on some of our Hong Kong and Chinese real estate developers, both in the Pacific Basin portfolio. And also there was a slight adverse effect in terms of the emerging market portfolio as well. But those were really the highlights of the portfolio's relative return over the last 6 months. What I also ought to do is just mention to you, given that we're nearly a month on from the end of March, as of yesterday's close, the portfolio's return for the year to date was actually 4.4%, and that compared with an index return of just over 2%. So the active return, and I don't have it net, but the active return gross for the year to date through yesterday is now 2.0%. So we've actually had a very strong April. Even though the markets have been relatively weak, the portfolio has outperformed very strongly. And that's been pretty much across the board as well. We've continued to add value in Japan, where April was a strong month for us. Also in the Pacific Basin as well, where the first quarter's underperformance of about 1% is actually now down to about 20 basis points. And similarly in emerging markets, where we were slightly behind in the first quarter, the active return from that part of the portfolio is now positive as well. I won't dwell in detail on page 16, but that shows you some of the major contributors to the outperformance in the portfolio. I've already mentioned Fuji Heavy Industries, the Japanese auto manufacturer that makes Subaru. The other big position that contributed positively to the performance of the portfolio was KBC Group, which is a diversified financials company based in Belgium. And then I mentioned PPR, which is one of those luxury goods manufacturers. I mean, it also, as well as the company I mentioned, it owns Boucheron, which is a very high-end Swiss watch company. It also owns the Stella McCartney fashion brand, which is the brand where the products are designed by Paul McCartney of the Beatles' daughter. I just thought that might be interesting. Some of the detractors in the portfolio are shown at the bottom of this page. China food, for example, in the emerging markets part of the portfolio, you can see it underperformed by 49%. That was a very disappointing performance over the last 6 months. They had some very weak financial results for the second half of 2012. They were facing some fairly severe competition in their wine business. And so that hurt those disappointing earnings results really hurt that stock. And also, you know, as I said, the energy sector was not a great area of outperformance for us, and Saipem, which is an Italian oil services company, was hurt by allegations of bribery over a contract execution in Africa, and so that stock underperformed the market by about 45% as well. Why don't I pause there and see if there are any questions?
I have a question for you. What's the value of our portfolio?
The value of the portfolio as at the end of March was, hold on a second, I can tell you exactly what it was. It was $139.9 million.
What was it at the beginning?
At the beginning of the period?
Yes.
I'm sorry, at the beginning of what period exactly?
The one you're reporting on. The last one.
Oh, the one we're reporting on. It would have been about $125 million, I think.
Okay. The reason I ask is...
So it's up about 10%.
Good. None of that information is here.
So, oh, I'm sorry, you're right. It isn't actually. The opening value is not in the presentation. I apologize. We'll make sure that it's in for next time.
Okay, that's what I was hoping for. Thank you.
Okay. Are there any other questions?
Doesn't appear to be. Go ahead.
Okay, so why don't we turn to, if you just look at the at page 17, the sector attribution, that page shows you where we added value by sector across the total portfolio and detracted. And what you can see, actually, is if you look at the final column in that page, you know, our position in consumer discretionary, financials, and telecommunications, as I've already mentioned, all added significantly to the outperformance of the portfolio over the last 6 months. And consumer staples was the big area where we saw underperformance. Just to mention again on the consumer discretionary, I mentioned a couple of those stocks that they were several of the Japanese stocks that were auto manufacturers or auto associated. Also, if you look at this page, you can see that there are two columns here which say stock selection and sector selection. If there's a positive number in the stock selection, that means that the stocks that we owned in that particular sector outperformed the sector, the other stocks in the sector. And then if the sector selection number is positive, that means that if we were overweight to that sector, the sector actually outperformed. So, for example, in the consumer discretionary sector, we had an overweight position of 2.4%. That's shown in the first column. Stock selection was positive, so the stocks that we actually owned on your behalf in the portfolio in that sector outperformed the broad sector. And the sector selection contribution of almost 17 basis points. What that means is that the consumer discretionary sector outperformed the broad market. And so what we're looking to do is to try and get as many positive numbers in these columns as possible. And you can see that also, generally speaking, the larger numbers will come from stock selection. That's where we try to add the most value. We tend not to take big sector positions relative to the benchmark. And that was true mainly, you know, pretty much across the portfolio. Obviously, the area that was of concern to us during this six-month period was the consumer staples sector, where actually the stock selection, so the stocks we owned, particularly in the portfolio, you know, underperformed the sector as a whole. That was China food, as I mentioned. We were overweight a company called Amore Pacific, which is a Korean cosmetics company that has very strong market share in Southeast Asia. But they were investing strongly during this period of time, and they were also hurt by the strength of the South Korean currency. And by consumers who were trading down, the cosmetics that this company makes tend to be slightly higher end. And as consumers were trading down, particularly during 2012, that hurt their profitability. So we actually had two or three stocks in that portfolio that in that area, in that sector, that actually underperformed quite significantly. But as I say, you know, what you can see is that there were very strong stock selection results out of the consumer discretionary sector, out of financials, where being overweight some of those European banks that saw significant recovery was very positive for the portfolio. We also owned within the emerging market part of the portfolio the second largest Brazilian bank, which also has several diversifying businesses, including a big insurance business. That particular stock was also a big contributor during the course of the quarter. So those were some of the key highlights to the performance of the portfolio. In the interest of time, if you turn to page 19, I'll just give you an idea of the positioning of the portfolio as at the end of March. There has been very little change, actually, during the course of the month of April. But if you look at page 19, you can see the biggest overweight is to the consumer discretionary sector. And that's a combination, really, of several of the high-end auto manufacturers are overweight positions, including Volkswagen with their Audi brand, which is selling well in China. Fuji Heavy, which I mentioned before, is the owner of Subaru. They're doing very well in the United States. And we also own several other luxury goods manufacturers that are doing well in Southeast Asia. In terms of healthcare, that sector is very stock specific. We own a number of more concentrated, more focused pharmaceutical companies. We're very underweight the big general pharmaceutical giants in Europe. So, for example, the main holdings in the portfolio are Sanofi and Bayer. And Sanofi is a French pharmaceutical company. Bayer is a German pharmaceutical company. We also own a couple of companies in Japan, including Ship Healthcare, who are major providers of services to hospitals. Those companies have done very well for us in the last 6 months. And then in terms of the industrials, that is another overweight position. We've been a little early into some of those stocks, but companies in that area that we own include Rolls-Royce, the manufacturer of both commercial and military jet engines for aircraft. That particular company has been doing well on the back of a very strong replacement cycle for civilian aircraft at the moment.
Michael, if you can hear us, we're having a bad phone connection problem, but I appreciate your commitment. Sounds like you covered everything, and we're having a good year, and please pass along our thanks to your entire team, and congratulations on your upcoming and pending retirement.
Okay, well, thank you very much. And I just in conclusion, I'd like to say thank you for your support over the years. You know, I think I've been actively involved with Stanislav since the beginning, since we were appointed, and it's been very rewarding for me. I hope it continues.
Well, thank you very much. So do we. And we look forward to another 20% next year.
Okay, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Could we have Rick explain this?
Yes. So looking at LSV first, this is the cumulative excess value or added value that they've given Stancera over the last 4 years and 9 months. And so LSV, you can see over the course of that period of time has added about $4.2 million to our portfolio. But they've actually been coming down over the last 2 years, whereas Pyramus in total has lost money on an added value or a value added basis, but they've actually been improving, if you notice, over the last year or so. They're actually gaining, but their negative is getting smaller, because they've been adding value over the last year or so. But, again, on a cumulative basis, LSV is doing much better than Pyramus has.
It might not be fair to ask the question off the cuff, but if we would have had this same page from Pyramus that told us beginning value, net contributions and withdrawals, return on investment, initial value, what would that look like on Pyramus?
It would still be, value would be greater than what the beginning value was.
Right, but it doesn't sound like a whole lot.
Well, remember, this is relative to the benchmark. If the benchmark earns 20% and they earn 19%, they're still adding a lot of dollars to the portfolio. But relative to the benchmark, they are losing money. They're not adding value.
Which is why it's really helpful for me to have real money.
Okay.
Yeah.
Rather
so
than all this numbers is really hard to follow.
How about if we get the? Should we ask these managers to stick this information in each time that they?
I would think that. Why would we want to have a report that doesn't have this information in here?
All right.
And it would even be helpful if yours, like right here in this column, had the same thing for us.
The
beginning asset value. So we can compare your numbers.
Yeah.
I just put just from what they had: beginning value, net contribution, withdrawals, return on investment, ending value.
Just give me that before you walk out of here.
Okay.
This realize that this information here comes directly is derived from Paul's work. I just copy and paste into the spreadsheet, and it takes your work and generates.
It'll probably make your work really easy to say, Paul, put this on your.
I've already got it, so I can just grab that.
We'll work together.
Okay.
It's not difficult.
The one difference between the manager self-reporting and. This is the custodian fees.
Absolutely.
And with Pyramus, that's been an issue, but I understand that's going to go down.
Which would be helpful. I mean, that's listed here.
Yes,
we have the fees, but we don't have real dollars.
No, I understand.
And I think it's probably good to know where we are against the benchmark and all that sort of thing. That's probably above our pay grade in terms of understanding on a regular basis. But we can understand, we started here, we took out this much, they added this much, and here it is.
Right. And you do incorporate that into your ultimate return calculation, is
yes.
what comes in and out. So
yes.
what you do see from Paul, what you're going to see in a few minutes, mm-hmm. that does incorporate the money we put in and take out.
Right. But we'll this
in
is...
In the letter that I send to the presenters, I can ask for those three standards in the letter. And ask
we'll stick it in there, though, because there's a
lot of... LSV did really well, but it would be helpful to have it from you, too, to know that... Mm-hmm.
Yep.
That was kind of comparing them.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, moving on to item 8A, discussion and action correspondence from Dodge & Cox regarding their ability to invest in over-the-counter OTC equity securities traded on foreign exchanges.
So this item, staff is going to be asking to not give Dodge & Cox permission to actually invest in these types of securities. Yesterday, Panasonic, this whole agenda item centers around Dodge & Cox's desire to continue to trade Panasonic. Yesterday, Panasonic decided to delist from the New York Stock Exchange. They cited low volume and excessive cost to list on the New York Stock Exchange relative to the volume that's actually traded on their stock. So they decided to delist from New York Stock Exchange and to start to list on the over-the-counter markets. So their shares will continue to trade in those over-the-counter markets. The over-the-counter markets are less burdensome to some companies. They don't have the SEC requirements that are put upon them to invest like they are on the New York Stock Exchange. One of the interesting things that I thought was in reading Dodge & Cox's letter that they don't have to conform to Sarbanes-Oxley to conform to right to be able to list on New York Stock Exchange. So essentially, Dodge & Cox is asking us for the ability to trade in these stocks, and also we'd have to go in and change our investment policy statement to allow for this. Currently, our investment policy statement doesn't allow for this type of trading in these types of markets, but there also are ways for Dodge & Cox to get exposure to these equities by trading in something called ADRs, American Depository Receipts.
Right.
And then Paul has some concerns that he's going to talk about before we ask you to vote on this matter.
Yes,
isn't there more trading going on off market now than there had been in the past?
Off market or after hours? What do you
there's a yeah. bunch of different.
Not on the stock exchange.
Yes.
New York stock
there's
exchange.
A, well, there's
there,
a.
There are other.
A lot of exchanges.
Platforms.
Yeah. Absolutely. There's
yes.
several platforms, many platforms.
Okay, so why is it that we've restricted ourselves to stock exchange transactions?
That's a good question.
Or base transactions?
It's more from a regulation and trading volumes and bid-ask spreads for our own protection. First of all, Dodge & Cox is a domestic U.S. equity manager for us. And they are, and we've given them permission to go up to 20%, I believe is the number, in non-U.S. stocks. That, I'm okay with that to a point. And the point being is that you'll never see a non-U.S. equity manager buy Microsoft, for example, in their portfolio. So we have two non-U.S. equity managers who just presented who can buy Panasonic and other issues that are in their domain while we allow Dodge & Cox and some of our other U.S. equity managers to buy non-U.S. stocks. Secondly, allowing Dodge & Cox to continue to hold Panasonic in the pink sheets I feel uncomfortable with because of regulation issues. Trading volumes, it was cited as one of the reasons why they're moving from the New York Stock Exchange is low trading volumes. And trading volumes and pink sheets, is my experience, can lead to large bid-ask spreads and also prices of that stock that deviate from the home country, Japan in this example of Panasonic, which is traded in yen. Now, Dodge & Cox cannot buy on the Japanese exchange Panasonic. Again, our non-U.S. equity managers can. And for those reasons, I just don't think it's appropriate because they are trading on a exchange that is
I won't say unregulated, but it's not nearly as regulated as the New York Stock Exchange. And I would feel comfortable allowing our U.S. equity managers to buy non-U.S. equities only on listed exchanges through ADRs.
But you could reasonably argue the New York Stock Exchange is overregulated.
Is what?
Overregulated.
I've heard both sides of that argument. I've heard both sides of that argument. Some companies claim that it's a burden to them. A lot of investment managers claim that it's been a godsend to them to have these extra restrictions and regulations thrust upon these companies.
I mean, clearly, we go through cycles of being below regulated to above regulated, and clearly the financial crisis has spurred a cycle going to more over-regulated, but there are protections to investors through the regulation of listed exchanges versus all these non-listed exchanges, including OTC pink sheets, third market exchanges, after hours trading, all that. And again, it's a case where, for example, Dodge and Cox wants to buy Sanofi, is it?
Roche,
which is a large pharmaceutical company that only trades on the U.S. pink sheets. Again, both our non-U.S. equity managers already hold that stock. I don't see the point, frankly.
I have a question about Sarbanes-Oxley. If Panasonic does this or Roche has done this, so they're able to avoid the requirement of Sarbanes-Oxley where the CFO and the CEO don't have to buy off on the validity of the financial statements?
Yes.
That's important.
It is. That seems to
Enron.
Be important.
Right. We've seen, you know, even in the U.S., we've seen companies go private, citing that as one of the reasons they go private, to save costs and all that.
I wonder how much this would open up the door to other purchases, you know, okay, so specifically Panasonic, but then would they want to be buying other things over the counter? And I agree with you completely about the volume and the bid-ask spread.
It could be wide as a truck sometimes.
Exactly.
And it's...
And hard to move if you want to get out of something.
And it's restricting them from buying stocks that are outside their domain to begin with. So I just don't see the reason for us to change our policy statement, which I think protects us maybe to the point a fault of being a little conservative, but we're restricting a manager's opportunity set to his own domain, whereas that opportunity set we're restricting is already covered by our non-U.S. equity managers.
Paul, I have a question. If they have to sell all this, do they, I'm assuming since it happened yesterday,
yes,
and they probably have more than one institutional manager with an investment policy that says no.
Right.
So will they just dump that 128,000 shares, or do they do it strategically?
We would obviously ask them to do it strategically at their discretion, yes.
So that brings up another point, is that they currently have about 128,000 shares, which is, I think, close to about $1 million based on Panasonic share price.
940,000.
Oh, that's right. Okay, yeah.
So what's the bottom line on that? How does that affect us?
In terms of the value of our stock, Kathy was alluding to,
yeah.
I would think that either we could remind Dodge and Cox to do this orderly,
yes,
or I would think that they would do it orderly themselves.
Yeah, they would do it orderly.
Have to
remind of course,
them.
They're a fiduciary, so they would do it orderly themselves. Yes,
but they wouldn't be required to do it.
And it's not a large amount of shares,
not really,
in the grand scheme of things.
Right.
So would we give them a window of time to do it in?
I'd say 30 days. That should be plenty of time.
Whatever you think the window is to maximize it.
Yeah, I think 30 days would be plenty.
You don't think that just delisting in general will cause their stock to...
I don't know.
Well, at least one thing one can say is that that's been probably known for a while.
Yes.
So the markets have been anticipating whether that was going to be a good or bad event for them.
I think there are other factors that would cause the stock to go up or down more than that.
Yeah.
But it is a factor. Yeah.
Are we going to see similar requests from other managers, given...
Or
passive managers don't hold non-U.S. stocks. A Delaware might hold one or two here and there. The two small caps shouldn't be really holding non-U.S. stocks either. So I think the answer is we may, but it would be few and far between.
You're shaking your head over that, Gordon.
I move staff recommendation.
Second.
So we have a motion by Gordon Ford, seconded by Mike O'Neill, to adopt the staff recommendation.
Is this like a 30-day window to get out, or how, what kind of time frame?
Well, I think Paul's statement was the best, and 30 days is the best window, but to optimize the best value for the fund to,
right,
to extract themselves from this investment.
Yeah.
Then it becomes a timing issue anyway.
Right.
Right.
So any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? So moved. Moving on now to item 9. Strategic Investment Solutions monthly performance review for the month ending March 31st, 2013.
Yep. We have the month March lead. We gave you a preview at the regular meeting earlier this month that we had another good month. And you can see by the index returns, U.S. equity indices were very strong for the month of March, up almost 4% for the month for the Russell 3000. And for the 3 months of calendar year 2013, up 11%, and 1 year now 14.6, and 10 years 9.15. Small caps outperformed large caps during the month, and non-U.S. equities lagged fairly significantly for the month of March, with the ACWI-X U.S. up 25 basis points, and emerging markets were actually down 1.7% for the month, as LSV alluded to. The strong U.S. dollar has been a factor with non-U.S. equities recently, as the euro has continued to weaken. And year-to-date, the ACWI-X U.S. is only up 3.3% versus 11.1% for U.S. So in retrospect, the moving of funds and adding to the S&P 500 index a few months ago has been quite additive, as rebalancing often is. Bond returns were muted for the month of March. The aggregate was only up 8 basis points, and year-to-date is flat, down 12 basis points. Finally, we have now come to the point where we'll do fixed income manager structure next, and that's one issue we've been talking about, and it hasn't hurt us up to this point in time, but you can see the returns of the aggregate bond index for the year-to-date. And 1 year on, 1 year at 3.8%. Well, part of the structure will be looking at different alternatives within fixed income to the aggregate core index. Turning to page 1, you can see the market value is up to $1.547 billion. We've been keeping domestic equities at the top end of the range, at 45.4 versus 41.9 target. They're 3.5% above. I don't feel a need to rebalance at this point in time. International at 17.5 is slightly below the benchmark, and that's due to the recent outperformance of U.S. versus non-U.S. Fixed income is at 35%, about 3% below target, and REITs are right on target at 1.5%. The next page, 2. We added $28 million from the prior month, so it was obviously a very good month, including the $3 million in distributions that go out to pay retirees on a monthly basis, and $120 million up over the prior year. So things definitely feel better, and this is showing that they are better. Page 3, each of the managers are listed, and again, targets are pretty much within policy range. Dodge & Cox fixed income is at the lower end of the range, but everyone else looks good there. And then page 4, the cash levels are relatively low for the equity managers.
at about 13 million. Again, we talked about the policy implementation overlay service provider that sweeps the manager's cash into their respective benchmark type of securities, and that's something we'll explore later on when we have time again. Page five, the performance for the month. Total domestic of 4.15 versus 3.92 at a 23 bips. Again, it's been a story for this fiscal year to date, 9 months of kind of adding a little bit every month, which is the best possible thing, I think. Consistency, and then when you add little by little every month, you get a fairly significant level of a fiscal year to date, 9 months, 20.55 versus 18.29 or 2.25%.
Getting back to the cash balance, is that fairly homogenous across the entire month, or does it fluctuate up and down?
It fluctuates a little.
Is there a way we can tell what it does intra-period a little more?
Yeah, we can do an analysis on
that.
Okay,
because that may actually help us in our cash flow analysis.
Okay.
As well.
Fixed income. 25 bips for the month versus 8 bips for the index, but fiscal year to date 4.2 versus 1.7, 250 bips of alpha for fixed income, with Dodge and Cox leading the way given their corporate overweights and spreads continuing to narrow. And the two non-U.S. equity managers who just presented also strong fiscal year to date, and both added value in March and February, so good news there. Total fund up 2.15 for the month of March versus 1.8 for policy. And fiscal year to date, the 9 months up 14.25% versus 11.78 for almost 250 bips of alpha, which is fantastic. April, we've seen the first correction in the markets, but it was only a magnitude of about 3%. And today was another strong day, and Apple had decent earnings after the close, and that stock's up after hours. So hopefully, you know.
We're about that, flat.
Yeah.
Probably flat.
Yeah, exactly. We're still doing okay. It would not be unusual to see a 5, 7% correction from the highs, given how much we've gained in recent periods. And the cautionary tale is the last 2 or 3 years is this quarter. Our last quarter of the fiscal year has been a weak quarter for the last 2, 3 years. But
so what's going to happen when the government stops buying of this quantitative easing and people start putting their money someplace besides the market?
I didn't hear that, John. What happens when the government...
QE stops, when they stop buying bonds.
When the quantitative easing stops and people have someplace else to put their money besides the market...
Well, that would mean that economic growth is stronger than it's been, and yields are going up where people have alternatives to put the money. Obviously, when that happens, it could be a fairly strong correction in the markets. But that said, I don't see that happening at any time in the near term.
Middle of 2014?
I can't answer that.
Ron?
If I was answering that,
we have to have jobs first.
I guess that's the response.
I don't think quantitative easing is
going to be. No, it's not.
Okay, any further discussion on 9A? Okay, 9B, report on the top 10 holdings by Stantera Investment Managers as of March 31st, 2013.
Right, I'll go quickly on this. Starting with BlackRock large cap growth, you can see the weakness at Apple at the top. It's gone from 700 down to 400. I think it touched 392-ish, but it's kind of flip-flopped with now ExxonMobil as the top cap company in the world. But it's come back the last couple of days, and I said earnings, but you can see the weakness there. What's been strong, Coca-Cola, Philip Morris, that the defensive type of issues that were mentioned by LSV have been quite strong from the get-go of calendar year 2013. It's been straight up for Coca-Cola, Philip Morris, the J&Js of the world, and you can see the relative performance there. Large cap value, BlackRock, the next page. Again, Pfizer, Procter Gamble, J&J, those have been the strong defensive type of issues, high-quality names that have done quite well relative to the other issues in the market. Capital Prospects, U.S. Value, more names down than up as of the middle of the month. Caution, that's only the top 10. Often we see that middle of the month, and the manager still outperforms by the end of the month, given what the rest of their portfolio is and what happens in the second half of the month. This month, Gulfport Energy, a name we always see, is widely swinging up or down, up 7% almost. Delaware, the next page. What is really interesting, and Nate and I both noticed this, that Apple's out of their top 10 holdings, which had been their number one position for so long. They still own it, but they've obviously trimmed that down. Five issues up and five down for Delaware. Moving along to Dodge and Cox, large cap equity, six up and four down. Hewlett Packard, which had rallied nicely from the lows, is back, going back down. And between them and the price action of Dell and the private takeout of Dell having issues, it's clearly PCs are slowing down at the expense of tablets and iPhones. Legato, next page, looks to be struggling with most of their issues down, 8 of the 10. Again, I would caution, wait to the month end and what the total portfolio is, but they might be having a rougher month. The S&P 500 with BNY Mellon, you see Apple, ExxonMobil, the top two cap names in the index. And again, the defensive type names doing well. And then the two non-U.S. equity managers follow, which I'll skip since they just presented.
Any questions on 9B?
Okay, 9C. Is now this is a follow-up on Medley from our last meeting, and listed here are some questions that we had after the last meeting. We had a good conference call between staff, myself, Scott Smith, who's our external attorney, advising us on these direct lending companies, and board member Gordon Ford also took part of that meeting. And the questions that Gordon raised were all relevant and additive to our due diligence process with Medley. And you can see the answers. We feel comfortable in the answers and the listing of the investments that were provided and the listing of the other LPs in the fund structure and the changes that were made to the side letter that also incorporated some of the these questions and other issues that the board raised, which included unsecured debt that none would be used, no leverage at the fund level, the temporary investment issues we had were all resolved, and that this fund, Fund 2, will not invest in any way in Fund 1. We will, as we've said all along, this is a learning process for all of us. We hope to be somewhat intelligent and use what we learn going forward. What we learned for Raven was applied to Medley, and what we've learned now for Raven and Medley hopefully will be intelligent enough to apply to White Oak, which we are starting this week, the due diligence process on that, and hope to present that to the board at the end of May. The May financial meeting. The good news is with White Oak, we don't have a closing date coming right around the corner. We'll have more time to spend and use these type of questions and information we learned to apply to our review in the side letter that we draft with them. But at the end result is we're satisfied that all the concerns raised by the board and that we had as staff and consultant were answered with Medley.
Okay. Any questions in regards to 9C?
For some reason, the organizational chart wasn't attached.
They are.
Yeah.
These are confidential, so we couldn't post them. We just got them.
I know. Yeah. Is this open?
Or is it just 15% or even LIBOR plus 11?
We just couldn't post it because it's confidential. We just got them. It says do not distribute confidential.
Well, it's
online. We couldn't put them online.
Sorry.
It's confusing.
It does. Plus, we just got them too.
Yeah. We have one extra item that we passed out. And I alluded to in the performance report the fixed income manager structure review. And Rick asked that we present a timeline. And no, by no means are we married to this timeline. But our intention would be in the next meeting in May to start off with an education discussion, which will kind of follow up what Rick is presenting today. And then in June, come back with a structure with an analysis of Dodge & Cox and PIMCO portfolios and talk about some other alternatives and bring in the liability matching considerations, which we want to do. From the May meeting, we hope to talk about other areas within fixed income that were not invested that the board may want to explore going forward, the potential to invest in, but by no means has to invest in. And based on May and June, we would expect in July, August to have some education sessions, maybe talk to PIMCO, who is very good at potentially expanding their relationship. Primo was back here 3-4 years ago. They're an investment grade CMBS, very conservative manager. That is a higher yield alternative. And there's a couple other managers and others not on this list that we might want to invite in depending on what happens in May and June. And then hopefully September, October period, kind of finalize the structure that may or may not lead to search activity. As we did with direct lending, we want to take our time, do it right, and you know, how long ever it takes, and we'll tackle the next asset class.
All right, thank you, Paul.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, moving on to item 10, committee reports, standing committees, the internal governments, excuse me, internal governance committee.
We received a, as was included in the package, a letter from Norman that they would be unable to perform the actual audit this year.
Who was that again?
Melman. And we staff basically inquired with Spiegel Companies if they'd be willing and able to do this. They have some previous experience with us, or kind of sort of set up already. So after the discussion this afternoon, the committee is recommending that we accept staff's recommendation to contract with the Spiegel Company to perform the actuarial audit. This one time only. Next year we're going out for an RFP.
Which is part of the normal course of business. We'll start that process in the fall. So that process would have been started regardless of whether this issue with Milliman had come up or not.
That's correct.
So this is a temporary solution to a problem that exists right now. And also, just to augment what Maria said, Milliman had said that they could do it for approximately the same price as... Siegel said they could do it for approximately the same price that Milliman had said and do it at around the same time, completed it around the same time. Milliman said that they could.
We're currently paying, or we had contracted to pay Milliman $57,000. So one of the things that the committee recommended is we have some kind of, we don't have an exact amount yet from Siegel, so maybe kind of cap it within a certain range, whatever that would be acceptable. I'm thinking maybe a 5%. But I don't know if that's reasonable or not.
I think it's reasonable. We can work on that.
Hmm?
We can work.
Yeah.
In reading Milliman's letter, is it correct to state that they have a risk profile that they use, and because as they state, certain third parties are suing our prior actuary, that exceeds their risk profile and comfort zone, so they don't want to do business with us?
Well, essentially, talking to Nick on the phone, he suggested that their
insurance carrier wouldn't indemnify them for this particular job because.
And that was going to be my next comment. Is this setting up a scenario where in the future, when we go out to hire firms to do business for us, we're going to have to maybe go out and buy our own bond specific to this type of work, which is going to cost this system even more money?
That's a possibility. I've never thought about that.
Well, it's what it looks like.
Or why don't make it part of the RFP process that they provide? So they're not qualified to quote if they don't have it.
You can absolutely start there.
Yeah, we'll put that whatever you want.
That would be my recommendation.
Yeah. I have a lot of contacts at Siegel, so I immediately picked up the phone and asked if this is something that they could provide us. And they said yes, and they also showed keen interest in the ability to bid for the job on a permanent basis for the next 3 years. So, and I talked with a couple of the actuaries there, and they understand why Milliman declined this job, and it didn't appear to bother them one bit. I think Siegel's involved with several other 37 Act counties who are going through some of the same thing.
So I'd like to put the question to the full board for action.
So do we have a motion from the...
Why don't you phrase it as a motion? A lot easier for you than us.
You want me to? So the committee's recommendation is to hire the Siegel Company to be hired on a temporary basis to perform the audit of the 2012 actuarial valuation and the 2009 to 2012 experience study. That would be the scope of their work on a temporary basis.
So it'd be a temporary or one.
And then did we want to add in about the in the future, or do we want to add in about, you know, a question about the bonding, or
I think that might be outside separate, of this particular yeah.
Okay.
That might be a separate.
Separate. Okay. We'll discuss that in the future. So the motion would be just specific to hiring the Siegel Company on a temporary basis to perform the work as stated in the agendized item.
Did you want to put a relative cap on that, like you suggested?
With a relative cost cap, sure. No more than 5%.
Do you have an engagement letter with them? Or is...
We will.
Yes.
And your cap would be?
I'm thinking 5%, what a staff think, in terms of that reasonable or too conservative?
A lot?
Well,
$2,500. Yeah, 57. Yeah, you're looking at $2,500.
You're talking about $3,000.
I have a feeling that they'll stay under that, but I would not agree that it sounds like a lot.
10% there?
No, 5%.
Okay.
60.
Okay.
60,000.
So with a cost cap of 5%. So do we have a motion to that effect?
So moved.
Okay, we have a motion by Ron Martin. Is there a second?
I'll second.
And a second by Donna Riley. Is there any further discussion on the item? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So moved. We're now on to item 11, Executive Director A, presentation, discussion, and action on Stan Sarah's draft 2013 to 2014 fiscal year administrative budget.
Kathy Herman's going to present this item.
Okay. In the past, what we've done is brought this to the board just one time and taken any changes and adopted it. This year, we wanted to give you an opportunity to ask more questions and maybe suggest other things that we need to include and before we finalize the budget. So I can either go line by line or I can open it up for discussion or if you have any questions on anything.
Why don't you give a quick overview on what your projected budget is next year relative to where we're coming in this year and just a couple of the big items that may have changed that.
Okay. Well, as we are projected to come in under our budget, not a whole lot under, but we're under it, so that's a good thing. We do have legal fees are definitely a big ticket item. And hopefully we'll be able to get travelers to reimburse more than they already have. So far this year, we've spent about $111,000 on advocacy just this year for legal fees for the two lawsuits. And
how much has Travelers reimbursed us this year so far?
So far, they've only reimbursed us $36,000. And because part of what that is, well, we have two insurance companies involved. So RLI did pay $50,000, well, about $70,000 for the other attorney on the second lawsuit for Nazarari. And so we had to pay the $50,000 because those fees were about $125,000 just for that lawsuit so far, and it's not finished. And the other one, the O'Neill case, this year we've spent about $111,000. So, and Travelers has reimbursed $36,000 of that. They will pay a portion of Reed Smith's fees. They only pay up to their allotment, which is about not quite half of what Reed Smith actually charges. So I wanted to highlight that.
There is an abusive faith provision in those?
No.
No?
No.
What did you call? I'm sorry.
Loser pay.
No, we will pay them. And going forward in the past, other outside legal counsel was budgeted under one account in order to track this better so that we can also make sure the insurance companies are reimbursing us accordingly. We have separated them out for the future and hopefully won't need to add any more line items. But that's where we at. We are out with the legal budget. It is a big piece of this. Let's see. Okay.
What are other professional services?
Other professional services, it will include our strategic planner, who is going to be coming in July or August. I have some proposed dates for that, as well as we're looking to go out for a custody bank search this year, and that there could be some additional fees for that. So I'm not sure where that's going to go, but I wanted to make sure and add some funds for that if we needed it. Any questions?
This isn't an action item at this point, just a review and
just a review.
Any comments to give direction to staff. So does anybody have any comments or direction to staff on the proposed budget that's been presented before you?
Thank you.
Last question I had is, have you really budgeted enough for legal counsel for disability applications?
Yes, and right now the disability process. I know that I don't do the disabilities, but I talked to Don and Rick, and they had changed some few things last year, and I guess now things are a little bit slow or have slowed down, and we're not moving as fast. So they're looking at the process. So I really didn't want to change the disability budget per se. It's been a good budget so far, and I didn't want to change it in case we do need it, because we're not getting them done as fast as we need to right now. So we are looking at the process right now.
Because for a while they were pretty heavy.
Yeah.
The process is definitely in a state of flux. The process is definitely in a state of flux right now, and we're taking a really hard look at every aspect of this process and trying to find out where we can enhance those processes. So I think Kathy's right. For us to commit to any specific amount right now is probably putting the cart before the horse.
Okay, any further discussion or direction for staff? All right, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Moving on to item 11B, update on implementation of payroll system for Stan Sara.
Kathy's going to take this one as
I
well.
I have that report. Okay. We've done a few things. One thing we did is a few of us went over and met with the directors of StanCog. StanCog is very similar in size to us. They started doing their own payroll and took control of their own salary and positions about 12 years ago. So they will be a good resource for us if we decide to go this route. I have a spoke to their payroll vendor, and I expect to get a written estimate from her to do something similar for us by the end of the week, so I should have some numbers. We have formally, we have sent a, not a formal memo, a memo, but in writing, a formal memo, if you will, to the CEO's office, asking them if it's something they could accommodate for us in their system. We really don't think that they can, means the PeopleSoft system doesn't, won't do it, but we wanted a formal no from them before we move forward on this. And hopefully, maybe they can, but I don't have that answer yet, but we put it in writing so that we could get something so we can move forward.
I think we kind of wanted to exhaust that possibility first, just so we don't spin our wheels. I don't want anybody coming back later and saying, why didn't you ask them for this, this, this? Or I don't want anybody at the county to suggest that, well, we could have did this for you later on. So I just want to make sure that we don't spin our wheels needlessly at this stage of this process.
It was rather interesting when we were speaking to Stan Cog. They do their own payroll and positions and salaries, and they contract back with the county for absolutely everything else, including their in the county's benefit pool, and they, you know, pay for it. So they're a good resource for us. There would be no reason for us to do much different than what they're doing, so that'll be handy. They have lots of stuff, and they're just around the corner, so we can ask a lot of questions if we need to. Let's see. And then I've actually sent out trying to get some information from Sackers to see if we would need to do anything else. Because there's so many pieces to this. In order for us to actually do our own payroll or take control of our positions and salary, we would need our own federal employer ID number. And there's lots of legal bits and pieces involved. But before we go too far down the path, we wanted to get more homework done. So we could bring
would
it
you
all
have to
you.
Go as far as the benefits manager and all that stuff?
We probably, hopefully not. We'd love to be able to contract with the county, you know, for as much as possible. We're not out to recreate all those wheels if we don't have to. But we may need to become a district. I'm not sure how it works. I'm not sure. So before we go too far down this path, we will be talking to probably Hanson Bridget and have them help us figure out what else we would need to do in order to do our own payroll and set it up that way.
Could you restate what our goal is here?
I was asked to find out what it would cost to do our own payroll. We okay. can't.
So is the determining factor if we can do it for less money annually, then that'll be, is there something else we're trying to do, or are we just trying to save money?
I don't know exactly what it costs to do our payroll for the county, but
why don't we?
Because it's bundled with cap charges. I have not broken it out to just payroll. I'm not understanding what value would there be to do our own payroll if we didn't have control of our positions. PeopleSoft can do the payroll. It's the problem is the positions. If we can't control our position and our salary,
is that the goal?
Is give us more flexibility.
You just have to go through the board.
Implicitly, that's the goal here, based on what we heard a few weeks ago.
Okay, state it again then, what the goal is.
The goal is to be able to implement our own payroll system functionality and to lay it out on the table, to be able to control our job classifications, to control the salary levels, and to control the merit promotional opportunities within that administrative capacity.
Okay, so to restate that,
yeah.
is this staff concerned that their salaries aren't high enough?
Jeff, I don't know if you were here or not. We had two board members that asked for this to be put on the agenda.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah,
Mike Lynch and Jim DeMartini both asked that this be brought back and researched by staff. So that's why we're at where we're at today.
I'm not clear on what we're trying to get to in terms of the answer.
Question was to do our own payroll, but okay. I don't think we can do our own payroll unless we have our own federal ID number. And quite frankly, there's no reason to do our own payroll if we're going to use all the structure the county already has. If we're going to use their positions, then there's no reason to do anything different. Jessica, it's about the positions.
It all came to a head when the position and our contract agreement with Rick came up for review, and his step increase or pay increase was called to question. In other words, we had made an agreement with Rick to pay him a certain amount, but it was outside of the county's classifications. So that we have to work within those classifications the way we're currently set up. So that's where the discussion started and where the exploration basically led to. And that's where we're at.
So is the determining factor of what it costs us to do payroll, or the determining factor on
combination.
How we can classify it?
It's a combination.
That's what it was. We were asked to ask for a different band, go above the band. It just that presentation with Nancy Bronstein's what did it. It irritated everybody on the subcommittee. Okay, if that's the way it's going to be.
I remember expressing your irritation.
I was very irritated. Yeah. So was Darren. And I forget who else on the committee. If that's how they're going to act, then we're just going to separate ourselves from them, the way Stancock did.
But to me, it makes it, if we can save money, then we should talk about it. If we can't save money, then we just need to figure out how we control our own job silos, for lack of a better word.
The county's got a process for changing job descriptions and increasing or decreasing classifications. If you anticipate what you're going to do, then you can present it to the county within their time frame and within their rules, and then there's no reason for us.
I disagree. I think that doesn't always work.
I think
for
the
that doesn't always work.
Well, nothing works every time.
I've been in the county system and tried to reclass things, and it can be a nightmare.
I've been through the same thing. But my question right now is this something staff ought to be spending time on versus other things that have a higher priority?
Well, let me say something to that. I understand, and I know I've not been here as long as most of my staff here, but I understand that this has had a genesis from a long time ago, that this issue has been talked about, has been approached, but nothing has ever been decided. So at the very least, I would like to see some effort put into this and then finally bring something to you folks for a vote that says, yes, we want to do this, or no, we don't. Let's drop this whole thing for once and for all.
If board members ask to have it, I have no problem with it. I just kind of want to know in my mind what are we what's the criteria that we're looking at?
The request I got was to find out about the cost of payroll. The problem is that goes around the position allocation, so we had to go there, even though the dollar amount was the first thing that actually.
Is the auditor's office the one that does payroll?
Mm-hmm. And Joan, specifically to your question or comment about the process that the county has. Yes, we're aware of the process. That's what was discussed at the subcommittee level. And we were told in that committee meeting that the county would not be supporting a position change. So
the particular one you were talking
about. Correct. Well, actually, any. Not only that specific one, but any changes at this time would not be supported.
This board's ability to act. Right. And make decisions independently.
So, right. That's how this whole thing has come about, and why the request to staff to do the work.
But what staff is saying now is this turned out to be a whole bunch bigger problem.
Well,
it is what it is
that we started with.
Back to Jeff's comment. That's part of this information. We get the information as a board. The board asks for this to be researched. We make a decision. It's either to our benefit or it's not. But we can't do that in a vacuum, and we can't do it unless staff does their homework, which they're trying to do. And it's going to take time to do that, and they're doing it the right way, and I appreciate it.
Okay. My question went to timing, too. I mean, is this the right time to be doing this?
We are prioritizing what's on our plates, believe me. And this may take several months to vet amongst ourselves and with you, but we're not pushing this up to the front burner.
Okay.
How does StanCog handle the workman's comp insurance?
Everything goes through the county. They contract with the county for it. So they're in the county pool for their workers' comp, their health benefits, all their safety. They still actually even use the county's payable system. We don't even do that. We do our own payables. So everything except for the position and salary classification control, and then they have to do their own payroll in order to have control of those, and they'd have to do their own payroll. The PeopleSoft system wouldn't or couldn't, or I don't know how, but it wouldn't accommodate them, or couldn't accommodate them, I guess. Yeah.
Stan, how long has StanCog been doing that?
12 years.
Yeah. I think it's important probably to note also in there, you know, that you may want to consider is the whole collective bargaining process.
Oh, absolutely.
I assume you would assume your own responsibility for collective bargaining, and you assume control of your position.
Yes.
Right now, we only have one representative member, I believe.
Yes. Yeah, that's why we have to do our homework, and we have to ask questions and research and bring it to the board and make that decision, have the board decide whether they want to do this or not. But unless we start doing a little bit of homework, we'll never have the answers.
Unless you have some ideas there, Stan.
Okay, moving on to item 11C, which is a presentation on bonds and pension liability.
This is not probably 20 minutes, depends on how many questions you ask. This is not a very complicated subject. It should go pretty quickly. I know, you guys don't want to hear this. So as that warms up, I want to tell you why we're doing this. The biggest reason is to create an awareness of how bonds and fixed income can be used as a liability hedge, and also why bonds are so expensive. You know, I'm going to wait until everybody settles down.
Okay, are we ready to go? Okay, let's get going here.
Anyway, as I was saying, we're going to be presenting two sessions, one now, probably one in June. And the whole idea is to present an awareness as to why bonds are able to hedge pension liabilities, why it's so expensive right now to invest in bonds to hedge pension liabilities, and why there has been opportunities in the past where investing in bonds would have been a good bet, and essentially everybody kind of missed the boat.
That's as good as it gets.
That's good. That's fine. So, essentially, a bond in its basic form is just a series of cash flows. That's all it is. It's a good or a commodity. And, it has a schedule of cash flows that it throws off, and at the end it throws off back its par value to the investor. So very simple in its basic form. Next.
Am I going the right way?
No, you went. So one can talk about a bond and a borrower or a seller and an investor, or you could talk about it in terms of a borrower and a lender. Generally, a bond is at the beginning, or when a bond is first created, it's a contract between somebody who borrows a set principal up front and between a lender or an investor who gives them that money. When that relationship happens, then the borrower is required to pay back interest payments, coupons, over the life of the bond until the last payment, when the borrower returns the coupon and the principal as well. After this bond is originally sold by the borrower, this bond then is able to trade or does trade in the secondary market, and then it becomes a situation where you have the seller selling the bond to another investor. Either way, though, that relationship is not altered, or it doesn't alter the discussion today. It works in both situations, whether it's an initial offering or whether it's in a secondary market. The bond, the functions that we'll talk about today are exactly the same. So again, at its very basic core, a bond is just simply a series of cash flows. And that series of cash flows is a commodity or a good that has a price determined by supply and demand. Just like any other good, like a loaf of bread, six-pack of beer, or whatever, market forces determine the cost or the price that they're willing to pay for that good or service. This is an extremely important concept in this discussion, and it should make perfect sense. The more an investor is willing to pay up front for a set of future cash flows, the lower his return. This hits home for me very much because I used to buy and sell baseball cards, and I realized quickly that my profits that I got from buying and selling baseball cards weren't made when I sold the baseball card. It was made at the price I purchased it. And so the lower that you can pay for a good that you intend to sell later on down the road, obviously the higher your return is going to be. With bonds, it's a lot more simpler because the bonds have fixed cash flows, and it's easy to determine the yield that you're going to get based on the price you pay as long as you hold that bond to maturity. And so by understanding the fact that the higher your return is, or the higher you pay for this set of cash flows up front, the lower your return is going to be, really helps to understand the relationship between the price and interest rates that we see going on today. And it also helps us to understand why bonds are a good hedge against liabilities. So essentially what you do, this slide is probably a little redundant, there is an inverse relationship between price and the yield on a bond. The higher the price, the lower the return, and vice versa. So what I tried to do is lay out why, not just from a theoretical perspective, but from a supply and demand perspective, why there's this inverse relationship between interest rates and the price of bonds. And the Federal Reserve quantitative easing is probably a very simple way to understand this inverse relationship. Essentially, what the Fed wants to do by buying these bonds is they want to spur economic growth by keeping the interest rates low. And the way they do that is to go out and buy bonds in the open market, which essentially decreases the supply of bonds. And when you have a demand that remains constant and a supply that's decreasing, what happens is investors are willing to bid up that price of those bonds to compete for what's left out there. And going back to what we saw on the slide previously, anybody who's willing to pay a higher price for the same bond is going to realize reduced returns on that bond. So by the Fed reducing the supply of the bonds, investors bid up the price, they are ultimately, keeping yields and interest rates down.
Does that include their own bonds?
They are buying, they're buying the Treasury's bonds.
Right.
Yes.
So it's the government buying the government's bonds.
Yes. They are two different entities. The Treasury and the Federal Reserve are different, but they are part of the same government. So if you remember back to your high school days or college days, you can plot this on a supply and demand curve, and there's an equilibrium price based on the actual supply and demand. When something happens, you can go to the next slide, please. When something happens that's non-natural, like for instance, I guess a good example in this area would be weather. When you have droughts, then that affects the supply. It's a non-natural event that affects the supply of a good or service. What happens is, if you remember, the supply curve shifts to the left, and that indicates reduced supply that's out there. And so what you have is a new equilibrium price, and that's exactly what's going on here. with QE. Another good example is, let's say that an investor holds a bond that pays 6%, and ultimately that company announces an accounting scandal, and so what happens is the quality of the earnings are diminished for that company. And so what you're going to see is some investors may want to sell that bond. I mean, we talk about things like that here when things don't go so well, about getting rid of assets that may not have the prospects that were once thought. And so in this case, you have just the opposite happening. You have the supply increasing because investors may want to sell that bond. And so what happens then is the market bids down the price of those future cash flows, that bond, and those new buyers ultimately will realize higher returns because of that. And so again, you see the inverse relationship here between the price and the yields. So that brings us to understanding what interest rate risk is. Interest rate risk is inherent in bonds. And so what happens is an investor can either do two things when he buys a bond. He can either buy that bond with the intent of selling later on down the road, or he can buy that bond with the intent of holding it until maturity. If the investor buys a bond with the intent of selling before maturity, then he incurs what's called interest rate risk. And that's because he doesn't know what his ultimate cash flows are going to be, unless he knows specifically when he's going to sell that bond. And he also doesn't know how the markets are going to affect the price of that bond between the time he bought the bond and between the time that he plans on selling the bond. So he doesn't understand how interest rates and market forces, supply and demand, are going to affect his cash flows. And so he incurs interest rate risk. And these next 10 slides will whip through. What I want you to see here is this is exactly what interest rate risk is. As we go through these next 10 slides, it shows what happens to the market price of a bond given 1% interest rate changes. So in this case, somebody buys a bond for $1,000, and if interest rates start to trend up, this is what happens to the market price of that bond. And so you can see the higher interest rates lead to depressed or lower prices of that bond, and lower interest rates lead to just the opposite. One of the interesting things about this curve here, there's something inherent in bond investing called positive convexity, and I won't explain the mathematical reasonings why we call it that, but essentially you can kind of get an idea from this graph. For a 1% change or a 1% increase in interest rates, the loss that you incur is less than the gain that you get from a 1% decrease in interest rates. So the downside risk is kind of muted with respect to the upside potential. You can see how the losses aren't as much as the gains going out there on the right-hand side. It's not a symmetric distribution here. And this is a characteristic or trait in bonds called positive convexity. That really doesn't have anything to do with our situation, but it is kind of interesting, an interesting characteristic of bonds. Okay, so then on the other side of the table, we have that an investor can actually buy a bond and hold it to maturity. In this case, the investor is going to know exactly what the future cash flows he's going to receive. And as a consequence, since he obviously knows what he paid for that bond, he's going to know what his return or yield is going to be. And so he's essentially eliminated interest rate risk. He doesn't have to ever sell that bond, so he doesn't have to worry about those 10 slides, those changes in interest rates affecting the market price of his bond. As long as you never go to sell the bond, changes in interest rates won't affect you, because you know exactly what you're going to be receiving. You get the coupon payments for X number of periods, and then you get the par value back when the bond comes up for maturity. Now, for pension plans, taking interest rate risk is a choice. Anytime our fixed income managers buy and sell fixed income before they reach maturity, they're taking interest rate risk. Interest rate risk can simply be, in this respect, can be likened to buying an equity and selling it later on at a gain or loss. And again, like we found out, or like we mentioned in the slide previously, though, investors in fixed income don't necessarily have to take interest rate risk as long as they hold a bond to maturity. So how can pension plans use bonds as a hedge against their cash flows? Well, essentially what you see here on this page is a schedule of cash flow that Stan Sarah is going to be required to pay through the year 2019. So it's obvious that assets that pay cash flows at specific times can be used to our advantage. They can be used to help us pay those cash flows. Next slide, please. So, and this is really the heart of the whole presentation here. If plans buy bonds that are dedicated to the payment of those future cash flows, those liabilities can essentially be wiped right off the balance sheet, essentially. You can remove the assets and remove the liabilities from the balance sheet, and what you have left is an unfunded liability that's much smaller relative to the overall size of the plan. So you have less volatility in your unfunded liability, and as a consequence, you have less volatility in your employer contribution rates. And the main reason that we can wipe those off the books is because the change in the price of those bonds doesn't even matter anymore, because we're using those bonds to pay cash flows. So we don't have to value the market. We don't have to value the market price of those bonds, and you don't see that fluctuation in our return calculations. And the actuary doesn't see that fluctuation in his calculations, because he has tied or linked those assets to those liabilities. And you get a lot. You get a lot of risk reduction by doing this. So the question here is, why do governmental plans take on interest rate risk? Essentially, everybody still does it. There has been some recent articles in Pension and Investments that are really starting to hit upon the fact that interest rates may be going up at some point in time in the future, and that government plans should start to take a look at the possibility, and that's exactly what we're doing here today. Why do we do it now? Actuarial smoothing. The actuaries are somewhat responsible because we try to smooth employer costs and smooth unfunded liabilities over an extended period of time. If actuaries didn't smooth, you would see employer contribution rates going from 0 to 40 back down to 10, and so that's why actuaries choose to smooth that. But what it does is, and I changed that, I don't know why it's back to masks.
Maybe I pulled the wrong one.
I had minimized those changes in the unfunded liability, but what that does is it kind of takes away our sense of awareness of the true volatility in the unfunded liabilities of the pension plan. So it doesn't, we don't have to address interest rate risk as much as we would if we were really paying attention to the funded status and the unfunded liability on a market basis. Not to say that it's wrong, it just leads one to not necessarily paying attention to the right things all the time, I guess is a better way of putting it. This is one thing that's always been a thorn in my side. There's always been a historical emphasis on total returns. Plans actually look at risk in terms of the ability for the plans to throw off high returns. And I see this that when we go to SACRs a lot of times, where a lot of the investment managers, the people that are there speaking to the SACRs groups, are focusing on ways to squeeze as much yield out of the portfolio as one can. And that's generally been the tradition of government pension plans, is that's the way we view risk in terms of how far, how close, how far away we are from meeting the discount rate, which is probably not, it's not necessarily a good thing to do when you're trying to fund benefits. There needs to be other ways of looking at pension risk, and so that's been a problem for us.
Does throw off high returns equal spending?
No, it means that people are seeking to get a high yield as they can to try to meet the discount rate that they're trying to achieve. Historically we've had high government growth rates, and those high government growth rates have continued to fuel the pension plans. They create payroll for us, and that payroll translates into contributions for the pension system. As long as governments are continuing to hire, then we have this new young payroll that's feeding the system, and it allows us to take on this interest rate risk. And I guess it's another way also that plans tend to overlook the fact that they have to pay benefits because they continue to get these nice influxes of revenue from the local governments. And as long as they have the ability to, then everything works out fine. But in periods of slow economic growth, and you have the higher benefit levels that we saw several years ago, when you combine that with lower tax revenues, then it starts to hit the plans harder, and it hits our plan sponsors harder, and they have more difficulty in making those contributions. And then finally, low interest rates are a reason why we are, why we are taking on interest rate risk. It's extremely expensive right now to actually look at starting to immunize your liabilities, and so it's cost prohibitive right now. It's just not a very feasible thing to do. And the system, our system and everybody else's system, is really not in a position anymore to ask our plan sponsors to pay more. And so low interest rates are making it very difficult for Stan Sarah and every other system to be able to take on these risk reduction strategies. There's nothing really left to do. So what does it cost today? What would it cost the plan today? We looked at 20 years of benefit payments Stan Sarah is responsible for. They essentially account for 80% of all our current liabilities on a present value basis. We looked at the government yield curve on April 4th. We added 1% for a risk premium to be able to stretch out into the corporate and the international market. And what we found is it would cost about $2.3 billion to be able to fund with a surety 20 years of benefit payments that we owe. If you compare that to the assets that we have on hand, about $1.5 billion, that leaves us with a shortfall of about $800 million today. For us to be able to then de-risk the plan, given the cost today, the assets that we have on hand, we'd have to increase the employer's contribution rate by 17% of pay for 20 years, because that's the 20-year amortization of that shortfall that we've had, which is clearly something we can't do, obviously, right now. But that slide is there to make a point. So this slide shows what the cost is to fund 20 years of benefit payments at yesterday's prices, in other words, yesterday's interest rates. These interest rates were taken directly from the U.S. Treasury's website, and again, 1% was added for the ability for us to go out and invest in corporate, high-grade corporate bonds and international bonds. And any place on this chart where you see a cost that's below the current level of assets that we have on hand today, $1.5 billion, would mean that we could have done this without asking for our plan sponsors for any more money. So you can see that in early 1990s, it would have cost only $1.3 billion to do it. So we could have did this and had about $250 million left over at that time. But you can kind of see from this slide that things right around the new millennium, things really started changing in interest rates and prices started rising to do this. If you go to the next page, this is even a more interesting slide. What this slide shows is what the rate increase would have to be for our plan sponsors for the next 20 years to eliminate pension risk at yesterday's prices, in other words, yesterday's interest rates. And what's very interesting, two things. One, you see several points in time in the past where we actually could have did something like this and lowered the employer contribution rate at the same time. You also see that right around 2000-2001, which is when most plans started enhancing their benefits at that point in time, and right around 9/11, from that point in time, interest rates have just steadily climbed and they really haven't looked back. And so there's never really been a point in time where this idea, this concept, would have been feasible for the last 7, 8, 9 years. But this slide is meant to show you that there has been points in time in the past, and in hindsight, it would have been very wise to understand what we understand now and to undertake something like this, these risk reduction methods. So that's all we're going to talk about today. What we want to talk about in session two in a couple months is when it might be attractive to jump back into bonds, at what level of plan sponsor costs can we support? We plan on talking to our plan sponsors and finding out, you know, what their tolerance is for contribution rates, and trying to make this board and staff aware that if and when interest rates do start to climb, we need to be having discussions about if there's ways to take advantage of that, how to do it, and how to explain the opportunities to our plan sponsors going forward, to where as an organization, as a board, staff, and our plan sponsors are all on board with this idea. Because if we're not all on board with this idea is probably going to meet a lot of resistance and it would be destined to fail. So we're going to be talking about these things in June, about when it might be wise to be able to do something like this. Yes?
Rick, I have a question. Are you looking at taking all the liability off the table? In other words, covering all retirees?
Or no.
Could you have portioned it out? Old retirees are going to die, you know, but new guys that are just coming into the system, just retiring,
they're
the ones who you would want to indemnify.
Definitely. What we were thinking is in session two is going to be a lot more technical. This kind of just set the stage. But what we were thinking is one of the decisions that can be made is how many years do we want to look at? It doesn't have to be 20 years. It can be 10 years based on what our plan sponsors can afford. But even just 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5 years is going to do a couple things. One, it'll start to take the risk off the table. Two, and I think very important, is that it keeps us aware as an organization, as a board and staff. It keeps us aware of what's going on out in the world today and the markets, keeps us focused on interest rates, and forces us to address these issues and confront these decisions if and when these opportunities ever do arise. This is extremely important that we, as a group, we understand what's at stake here and what we may be able to do later on down the road if things do start trending upward for us in terms of interest rates.
I would just add that it's, I think the other metric is what the funding ratio of the plan is. And as the funding ratio improves, knock on wood, and if it reaches a certain level, whether it's 90-95%, then you might want to enact, almost regardless of what interest rates, obviously if interest rates are higher, it's better, but to immunize a subset of the retiree population. And given where rates are today, are so low, I agree. You start immunizing a subset of the oldest retiree population. And as your funding ratio continues to improve, you keep adding to that initial group with other groups. And if, you know, we see the funding ratio 105-110% sometime in the future. We may not be here, but then you would end up not immunizing the whole plan, yes.
I think that I'm not here to tell you that interest rates are for sure going to go up. I think that they probably will at some point in time. I think we're still a few years away from this. But again, like I said earlier, it's just important to understand the opportunities that may exist if and when they ever do get here again. I would hate, if you could go back a couple slides. I mean, when I see that right there, when I see this slide right here, I realize, I don't even know what the right word is. Maybe it was hubris back then for all those pension plans that we were earning 15-20% returns. There was such wonderful opportunities at that point in time to do something that, and if we had done that, that was 10 years ago, we probably wouldn't even be having a lot of these discussions on alternative investments. We probably still would be looking at alternatives, but a lot of these discussions and issues that hit pension plans hard over the last 10 years, we'd probably be saying, it doesn't really bother us much. So it's a shame that these opportunities weren't realized back then. But there was actually a time when I had brought something to a group at my former employer about opportunities back then. And in a meeting behind the scenes before this agenda item went before the board, they told me and a couple of my staff that didn't make sense for us to do anything like this when we were getting 15-20% returns. In other words, why would we be this stupid to actually you know, give up 15 to 20% returns for 8% returns from fixed income.
That's the thing. I mean, not only were you could have done it when your funding ratio was 100% or better, but you would be doing it at a time when interest rates went from 6 to 8% to 0 to 2%.
Exactly.
Your bond portfolio would be worth so much now.
Exactly.
That you could...
Well, that's a good point. However, had you done something like that, the value of your bond portfolio would be secondary to the fact that...
I agree.
Yeah.
But it would...
Yeah.
So. Well, you'd actually have to buy the bond and hold them, not invest in them. Mm-hmm. And a bond manager who churns that portfolio.
Exactly.
You'd have to buy longer term.
You'd buy a ladder.
And the other point you made was how the plan sponsor looks at, you know, everybody thinks this growth is going to go on forever. We're always going to have new employees. We're going to be, you know, the world's never
right. That's a very difficult obstacle
so that,
to overcome.
To get off the boat at that point in time is not that easy.
It's not easy.
And you're right, with the 15% returns or 20% returns, people would say you're crazy.
Exactly. So I hope this kind of sets the stage for us.
Yeah. Well, hindsight's always 20/20.
It is. But I don't think anybody really did any type of education about the possibilities back then.
But I think we talked about it after the explosion. We have 47% of our portfolio in bonds.
Yes.
Which saved our bacon. I mean, we took a huge drop in the... and the overall value of the fund, but nothing compared to what...
Yeah, we didn't rebalance for like 2 years. Yeah.
Right. So we weren't that smart. We were pretty darn lucky.
Sometimes luck is good.
Lucky. Yeah.
That's it.
Okay, we're going to take an item out of order just because one of the closed session items, which will be brief, two of our members have to recuse themselves. So, item 13, members forum. Gordon, do you have anything?
Pass. Nothing.
Red. Joan? No. Ron? Nothing. Jim?
Today.
Mike?
No.
Okay. No. Donna? Maria?
I just had a thought. We haven't had any recent information on our IT system.
Okay.
You know, and it's
We're totally positive you were going to be here today, Maria. So we had it, we took it off.
Okay, and I'm talking more about, because for a long time we focused so much of our energy on our benefit issuance and so forth. And, I mean, it's probably a good thing. I haven't heard anything, bad, so
right.
Must be working okay. But we've had a lot of changes in how we pay out our benefits. Now we have additional tiers and so forth. Was our system able to meet those needs?
With minimum changes so far, yes. All the members are, all the employer members are giving us the information we need. The system's able to take it in. We're still working. We haven't yet modified the estimator to calculate the Tier 6 benefit.
How about if we do a brief update for you next time? Would that be okay?
Perfect.
I'll put this
okay.
down. And
great.
Yeah. All right.
Put it on there.
Yep. Kathy, do you have anything?
Just that we're getting close to having some strategic planning dates, so we will be emailing everybody. We're looking at either July 17th or 18th or August 21st, 22nd. So that will be coming out to you within the next day or two, and if we don't hear back, we'll call you and try to nail this down to a date for everybody.
What were the August dates?
21st or 22nd.
Okay. Kelly, do you have anything?
No.
Rick, do you have anything further? I just want to put it in everybody's head and start thinking about it. You know, one of our board members, Ron Martin, is getting close to the end of his tenure. I mean, obviously, we want to thank him. We're not quite there yet, but I would like staff to have some ideas as far as how we're going to honor him for his service before he departs to sunny lands and good times. So
got a plane ticket to Hawaii.
Yeah.
Tomorrow morning.
Not
so
there.
That's it. And now I'll take a motion to move into closed session.
Make a motion to go to closed session.
Second.
We have a motion by Maria, second by Ron Martin to move into closed session. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? We are now into closed session. We'll wait for everybody to depart the room. Opposed? All right.
Hammer.
Anything else for the good of the order? Meeting adjourned.
All right.